Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Larry.
My sobriety date is May 2nd, 1982. And I want to thank you guys for letting me come out and visit you today. It's good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm glad to see Mike and Dave and all the guys and Steve and everybody. And it's great because this is a chain of sponsorship for me. You know, we all are linked together here, and I'm kind of like your dirty uncle. But there's one thing that I've learned about Al-Anons, and I witnessed it here tonight. They don't drink no matter what. I watched her talk for damn near an hour, and she had no water. This is not going to happen to me. All through her talk, I'm going, she's got to be thirsty, man. Drink. Drink. You know? Lick your lips. Do something, man. And Al-Anons don't drink, man. You know? I don't care. You could be on fire and they wouldn't drink and spit on you, you know? No way. Me, I stopped drinking coffee 5 days ago. Just so I could start up today. Yeah. I mean, that's the way I am. I drink for effect, and I'm a loser. I want to thank Steve for picking me up at the airport. I had kind of a trying day. I was on the runway in Long Beach for about an hour waiting for the thing to take off, and we were running a little late, and I even had trouble getting to the airport. You know, I just sped away this morning, and my glove box opened up on the way to the airport, you know, and I kept on trying to slam it shut, and it kept plopping open, so I speeded up and slammed it shut. Turned off the radio, it plopped open, so I speeded up a little faster and then brought it up slowly, turned the key, and it plopped open. So I speeded up again and slammed the son of a gun and then locked it. The idea of leaving the damn thing alone never entered my mind, you know. I'm going to work on that thing all the way to the airport, goddammit, you know, and I'm getting into it. And as I stand here tonight in Texas, the car's over at the airport and the glove box is wide open, you know, but I got a long ride home. You betcha, and this time it's going to be different. I don't know about surrender, you know, but I was just glad to land, you know, and you held up Steve for a while, but I was glad to hear Steve and meet me at the airport and stuff. And, you know, I asked him, how you doing? And son of a bitch hasn't stopped till about 10 to 8, you know. And I'd never met Steve, but I know everything about him now, you know. It was about 10 miles for every year he was married, you know, and but he's been a great host and a good guy, and I identify with Steve. I mean, more than that, listening to him, I became a happy man. I mean, you know. No, I mean, that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. If we're new, I want to welcome you, you know. I'm treated by your turmoil, believe me, you know. I mean, AA's the only place you can come where a guy's got his ass hanging out, and the guy listens to him's going, oh, boy, I'm feeling all right now, man, you know. Yeah, you know. But it's not that way. We're not laughing at you. Yeah, we are. Because we identify, you know. Nobody comes here happy and well-adjusted, you know. And I'm just glad to be here with you guys because of the sponsorship link, and more than that, because of the enthusiasm of the way of life we have. You see, I've got a loud head. I've got a busy head. My head has teeth on it. And if I'm not feeding it Alcoholics Anonymous, it's going to chew me up alive because they don't care I'm in AA. My head loves to talk to me. I pray for days off, and when I get them, I may as well just hang myself in the garage, you know. I mean, it's relentless sometimes, you know. I could be physically beat, and I'll go home, and I'll lay my head down. Physically beat, lay it down, and my head goes, "Hey, Larry, let's chat." No, I don't want a small talk. Save that small talk for your A&As, you know. I want to talk about when you were a kid and bring you right up to date, you know. And the only thing frustrating about that is we just did it the night before, you know. I mean, it just never cares, you know. But Alcoholics Anonymous has been the only thing that quiets that head, you know. That's the neat thing about having meetings that I know I'm going to attend. That's the neat thing about having I survive in my rut. May be boring to some people, but it's my survival. I count on my Monday night meeting, my Wednesday night meeting, my Thursday night meeting. I count on those because in between, it all breaks loose. But I know on Monday night, I'm floating into a safe harbor, man, you know. And I'm all for a home group because that's where me and people like me learn about taking care of your home, taking care of your home group, learning about brotherhood and sisterhood and respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, and maybe keeping people from running away from home. You see, this is where we do our chores. This is where we do our work, not behind this box. In our home group is where we do our, for me, you know. And so I'm preaching to the choir, I'm sure, but I'm glad to be a singer in that choir because I've never felt so part of life in my whole entire life as being with you. I love being with you. You see, my sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for close to 23 years and not amount to a goddamn thing. Oh, Johnny's so cool. Not when he's sponsoring you, you know. I've put up with his brutality for 20 years, and he's coming along just fine, you know. He's treated by my turmoil, you know, and it's weird, you know. So if you're new, I want to welcome you, and you probably feel like you're in your final hour, you know, and I understand that. In fact, we hope you are, because then you can start your hour with us. Not until then. We hope you're all done with whatever it is you need to do, you know, and so you can start this way of life with us. And it was talked about earlier about sponsors, you know, get a sponsor. And if you don't know what one is, years ago in the racing industries, I don't know if they have drag strips out here, but in California we got a ton of them. And years ago, these dragsters were going so fast that the front wheels were leaving the ground. And it was killing the drivers. So the engineers got together and they designed this thing they put on the back of the dragsters so that they don't fly away and kill these. It's called a spoiler. Hence the name sponsor. Bear with me now. Get yourself a spoiler who doesn't care how fast you're going, but is concerned that your feet are firmly planted here. See, my sponsor's not tuned into my emotions. He doesn't care about how I feel because he knows they're going to change any second now, you know. But he's concerned on where I'm going. He's concerned on where I'm going and what I'm doing. He doesn't care anything about what goes on up here, but he's concerned about what goes on right here. He's concerned with my feet. In Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new, AA is going to do to you what you've been doing to people your entire life. We're going to use you. Yeah. Yeah. Be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life, man. I swear to God. Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't get up and go, yay, I get to go to Texas. You know what I mean? But my... You know? But Alcoholics Anonymous took the only decent thing I've had, and they trained it. You remember how you used to automatically at 3 o'clock go to the liquor store? Boom. It was automatic. Boom. You know? Well, Alcoholics Anonymous trained my feet. Because I can be in the shower. The hardest time for me before meeting time is 2 hours before meeting time. Nope, I'm not going. Feel kind of sick. You know? I'm not going. He's going to be there. I'm in the shower. God damn it, it's too hot out. I'm not going. And before you know it, hi, my name's Larry. I'm an alcoholic. I'm automatically going to some place because I've been trained to do that. You see, my head don't have power over me no more. And my head's always had power over me. My God, how many times were you ready to cash it in? You know what? I'm all for the idea of not drinking. I'm ready, man. I'm physically beat. I got chunks of liver in my drawers. I got, you know, I'm all set. You know, I'm buying the idea. Yeah, let's not drink, you know. all to the beck and call of 3 days later, man, you're pounding on, you know, knowing perfectly well because your head's telling you, come on, kid, this time it's going to be different. Come with me. You see, and that's where my disease centers, right in here. My head don't care about me getting sober. My head's designed to do one thing, get me loaded. And if you're new, Alcoholics Anonymous and a sponsor is going to get you in a position in your life where you'll be able to carry this message and an obsession to drink will be removed. And nothing else will make that obsession go away. You'll try, and you know what? And what I'm seeing in AA, and if with this home group, you know, to the untrained eye, it looks like we all get along, you know. But I know about home groups. But anything about a home group is you will see personally what works and what doesn't work. And what I see personally in my home group, and I'm not sure about Texas, but to if you're new, and even not so new, but to the untrained eye, it looks like people come to AA, they get their life together, they get their little jobs back, and they get their little positions in life together, and they get their life going, and it seems like alcoholism is treated with normal living. And nothing could be further from the truth. Normal living is just a process of hard work and good fortune. But to some people who don't want to get involved into an active group, they start going to these other things thinking that that's treating their alcoholism. And for people like me, there's the first paragraph of working with others. Practical experience ensures me that nothing will immune me from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics. Not getting a 401k. Not getting a degree. And not finding her. These are all good things. But I tell you, they're not the treatment for alcoholism. So if you're new, get yourself a sponsor. Get yourself a sponsor and get you, like the lady talked earlier, get yourself a couple people that you can get sober with. Because there's nothing more heartbreaking than to see a guy come in and start hanging around his old buddies. Come in here and get some guys to get sober with and go to meetings and fart in a car and, you know. You know. And, you know, and a couple guys you can talk to about your sponsor, you know. And see if that guy's telling them the same stuff, you know. And come with us. You know, come with us and just go with the herd. The book talks about monkey see, monkey do. It's the herd instinct. And, you know, God, I hope you just find a monkey to follow. Because there's a lot of jackasses dressed up as monkeys, you know what I mean? So make sure it's a monkey, you know what I mean? So, you guys got the best, Joe. Anyway, so... I come from a great home. Go into that, being in that gym, in that high school gym, just brought on a wave of bad memories. I had a tough time in high school, you know. In fact, I'm a loser. I'm a hostile loser. I've always been a loser. I've always had a chip on my shoulder. I've always demanded to feel special. I'm the type of guy who all my life, I've done average things expecting standing ovations. Yeah. I'm the type of guy who does 8 hours of work, and I think my boss is in the office going, Jesus Christ. Man, they just don't make them like that anymore. I mean, my God, the guy only took a half hour lunch. I mean, you know, Jesus, where do they get these people, you know? And I'm that way today, man. I put a toilet seat on for my wife. I waited 4 weeks for that woman to say something, you know? And she's in AA. She's 12 years sober. And every time she'd come home from that meeting, I'd be waiting up in bed going, come on, Rosie. Jesus, you know, I mean, you know, get out of yourself. You know, I mean. Jesus. You know. I mean, what kind of program are you working? You're sitting on a brand new piece of wood in there, you know? You know, and not even a thank you, you know. I finally had to tell her, you know. But that's the way I am, you know. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I make coffee and I think my name's going to be in the grapevine, you know. Larry Thomas makes coffee for a big group. Isn't he wonderful, Bill, you know. No, I tell you, I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. And when I was in high school, man, I swear to God, I was such a loser. I got arrested my freshman year for being drunk. And me and my dad are in the principal's office, you know. And when you're a loser like that, people are always bringing people to your side to compare you to. why don't you try to be like Bobby, for Christ's sake, you know? And I remember being in there with my dad, and up on the wall was a star quarterback of the high school. My dad looked at him, and he goes, why don't you try to be like Coy, for Christ's sakes? I said, man, I'll never make it, Pop, you know? My next year, I got arrested for being loaded on barbiturates and wine, and I stole the janitor's cart, and I drove it through the library door. I had to get that book back, you know, and so me and my probation officer are sitting in the principal's office, and my probation officer says, you know, why don't you try to be like Coy, the quarterback, you know? Well, you know, next year my sister starts dating some guy, and she brings him over for the family to meet, and hell, it's old number 7 right on my couch, you know? Yeah, my mom comes over to me, and she says, why don't you try to be like Coy, you know? Well, my senior year, I'm in the Torrance jail getting ready to do 90 days. And some guy slides a newspaper in there, and it says, Coy makes all pro CIF. And I said to myself, God, I'd like to be like Coy, you know. And it seems like what goes around comes around in ANA. And in California, on every street corner, there's people selling peanuts or oranges. Or they have this sign that says, I'll work for food. Like you don't, you know. And... Got to be from Kansas, you know, and just kidding, really. So this guy, and I'm in my van, and it's a hot day, man, and the guy's on the corner, and I'm 5 years sober, and I got $2, and he ain't getting it, you know. And I'm the cookie lady in my meeting, and I need them. Anyway, the guy sees me in the truck, and he makes a beeline for my van. He comes running over to his truck, and he goes, Larry Thomas. And I go, Coy. I said, my God, I thought you had it made, man, you know. And I flashed through my mind. I said, you know, if my sponsor was any kind of guy, maybe he could shoot Coy a letter saying, why can't you be like Larry, you know. But people have always looked like they've had it made, man, everywhere I go. And I come from a great home. My mom, you know, I was born in Detroit. I come out to California when I was about 4 years old. We brought up in a little foster home for a while. My mom was a little Scandinavian lady, and my mom loved diet pills. My mom loved speed. My mom was always buzzing around the house around 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, sorting out nuts and bolts in the garage or night, you know, or... raking the neighbor's yard around 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, and getting the power edger and doing the whole block, you know. Always had that look of determination, you know, and you'd come home from school and she's moving the fridge by herself, you know, because she's going to do some waxing, goddammit, you know, and get out of the kitchen, you know, and just a fiery little blonde, you know, and she had her favorite thing was to do Afghans. My mom was making Afghans... all of her life. Everything in the house had a fresh Afghan. The couch had Afghan. You know, chairs had Afghan. My guess, golf clubs had poodles she knit, you know. If there was any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. I mean, I had booties and gloves and, you know, everything was yellow and blue, you know. And everything was made the night before, you know. Everything was fresh, you know, and... just a busy lady. And, you know, I grew up on these mom tales, you know, and these mom things, you know. Don't play in the gutter, you'll get polio, you know. Burnt food is good for your gums, you know. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm waking up at 6 in the morning, she's hovering over me, you know, and she, her, you know, eat this toast before you go to school, you know, and it's burnt, you know. And I make out for the door, and she says, you know, don't you make that face, burnt food is good for your gums, God darn it, you know. And she did not have a tooth in her head, you know, and... I said, you know, maybe you should have this, you know. She had a hobby. Her favorite hobby was to take that speed and make these big jigsaw puzzles, you know, of the Mojave Desert, you know. That way you don't get a piece mixed up, you know, the 30 million piece. And she'd go down to Save-On drugstores and she'd get a carton of Raleigh cigarettes because she saved the coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, you know. One that I know you know about, you know, and she'd get that big 30 million piece puzzle, come back home, put her only muumuu on. She owned one muumuu her entire life. That thing was wearing thin, you know. Put this purple peroxide on her hair, take a couple more Dexies and start firing up these Raleighs and start making this puzzle, you know. And she had a big pair of toenail clippers, because if she had a piece that was too big, well, she's snipping that son of a bitch down, you know. We had a job to do, you know. It looked like that cross up there, all those mosaic pieces and stuff, you know. And then she'd frame them and put them over my bed, you know. But that she loved me to death. My mom loved me to death, and I knew that. There was no doubt in my mind that woman didn't love me. And I played her like a fiddle. See, that's what I do when people show me any amount of attention or affection, is they go on a filing cabinet here, because they're going to be pulled up one day. I know that. And they are pulled up again and again. I could take a matchbook with a number on it. I don't care what the name is. I'm calling it. Because that could be an ace in the hole right there, you know. And my mom loved me to death. Now, my dad was a refinery worker. My dad was a World War II vet. My dad was a happy drunk. He was a happy singing the blues and that King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk, man. He loved to drink and he loved to sing the same song all night long, you know. The same verse all night long, you know. Yeah. I could hear him in the garage and I wanted to come out and hit his head so it'd skip it to a new verse, you know. And my dad, he made it very clear. He said, you don't know how good you got it. Back when I was your age, we really had it tough, kid. You know, and he did have it tough, you know. I mean, his father choked on his tongue and died at a young age. His mom hung herself in a Detroit jail when he was 13. She was a drunken whore. And he brought up his kid brother doing side work, and he had a dream. And that dream was to go in the Navy, marry my mom, get her out of that convent she'd been in for 14 years, come out to California and live that dream, you know, get that home. And I became a nightmare of that dream. They actually planned on that, you know, and I became the nightmare of that dream. And my dad used to tell me how, you know, how good you got it and you know, how grateful you should be that we got a roof provided. And you know what it did is it made it very hard for me to whine about anything, but it made it very hard for me to ask him help for anything, because I figured that I've got to learn to do this myself. Look what he did with his life. I've got to learn to do this myself, you know. And being a drunk, my dad's always sneaking in his house, you know, and he's coming through my bedroom window, you know. 12 o'clock at night, I feel this big boot coming down in my window, and I grab it, and I said, you know, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, you know. My God, she's up anyway, you know. I mean, I can hear the Hoover going now, you know, and but my dad was my hero. I admired that man. My dad, I love that. I learned to love him when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned to stay away from him growing old because he reeked of responsibility. Now, anything that has anything to do with responsibility, I'm staying away from. I mean, I can smell responsibility a mile away, and I'm going this way. I have ran from responsibility my entire life, you know. It makes guys like me thirsty, you know. And around 11 years old, there was about four of us in a garage. And I'm just a regular goofy kid, but I know that everybody else around me seems to be getting some kind of satisfaction out of everyday living. They seem to be going to school and playing sandlot football, and they seem to be okay with that. And I got a busy head. I got a head that tells me that I'm no good. I got a busy head that tells me that I'm different. I had one dream my entire life, and that is to one day think, be, and become normal, because I knew I wasn't. Maybe one day I will think or behave or feel normal, because of my own, I've never felt like that. I've always known, man, that I was a little off. And I didn't care if people found out that I was drinking. I just didn't want them to find out that I was that goofy. And that afraid is what I've turned that into be. And that's selfish. But it was fear, and I didn't know what to do with that. But there was about four of us, and we're in a garage, and we start passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, my head and my gut came together. There was no more conflict in life, no more doubt, no more ongoing pep talks. I've lived my entire life. It's been a lifelong of pep talks. All my life. Come on. We can do it. I just can't stand pep talks no more. I pep talked myself into the insane asylum, man. I can't handle it, you know. But I've always talking to myself, come on, just tell me it's going to be okay, and it ain't okay, man. And around 11 years old, man, I took a shot of Four Rose whiskey, and it turned Howdy Doody into James Dean in two drinks, man. And I loved it. I loved it. Bob was a natural at playing baseball. Betty was a natural at math. This thing came natural to me. I wasn't as scared of it. Nobody talked me into doing it. I didn't have to read about it. I took a shot of Four Rose whiskey, and it was everything I hoped it would be. I found peace in my head. It quieted it down a little bit, and I knew everything was all right, and I felt good about being me for the first time in all right, man. And I rolled up my smokes, and I felt solid, man. And then I threw up, you know? And, you know, I didn't head out to Skid Row the next day, but I got the address, you know, because I knew I'd be leaning on that stuff for a long time. I knew that I found my ace. I knew I found my secret. I knew I found my thing that was going to get me by in life, because I don't know how to give anything 100%. I'm a cheater. I'm taking shortcuts. I'm the type of guy who thinks I can do what you're doing and get away with not doing it the full thing. You know what I mean? Taking shortcuts and stuff like that. You know, and around 11 years old, I took a shot of Four Rose whiskey, man, and I didn't, you know, it was easy to get. I always had a little flask with me. I had my dad's Thunderbird wine, and there was always stuff with me, you know. And by the time I got into high school, I started dating this little Mexican girl, and she introduced me to her brothers. Her brothers liked cars, you know, and I started hanging around these lowriders in California. And what you do when you're a lowrider is you get your hair up real big with shit, you know, with hairspray and stuff, you know. Looks like an Oklahoma tumbleweed, man, up there, you know. And you drive around and you listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and Smokey Robinson and Marvin Gaye. And God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck the other day and the Four Tops came on. I just start sinking in my damn truck. I loved it, man. I had a Mexican girlfriend named Lupi, and she curled her hair up real big, and I'd get my hair up real big, you know. And I'd have these white T-shirts with these black khaki pants that came on to here, you know. Somewhere along the line, somebody told me that men who are well endowed had big feet, so I got me a pair of 15-inch shoes, you know, and I'd drive around with big hair and big feet and big ideas, man, you know. Yeah, I'd drive around all day drinking that Thunderbird wine, making the miraculous discovery in that mirror. Jesus Christ, are you good looking? That's your problem, man. You're too good looking. The women are afraid of you. The men hate you. You're going to be out there by yourself. You're too sharp for society, man, you know. And I'd start drinking that wine, and my hair would get bigger. My eyes would get bluer, and I'd look in that rearview mirror, and I'd see all those cigarette butts stuck in my hair, you know. I'd have about 50 pounds of puke on my chest, you know, and I'm feeling foxy is what I do when I feel like that, you know. I see a little 105-pound arm, and I press it against that car door to make it look big so you don't mess with me, you know. And I loved it, man. I loved it. And when you're in high school, you're always taking driver education, you know, like you haven't driven before, and they always got you with the biggest football coach in the world, you know. And I'm taking summer school because I'm always getting kicked out of regular school, you know. And it's a hot summer day, and the coach says, "All right, Thomas, get into the car." So I get my hair into the car. I sit in there, you know. There's these three girls in the back seat, and he goes, "All right, kid, I want you to parallel park." So I go over and I parallel park. He goes, "Well, you did pretty good." He says, "It's kind of a hot day." He says, "Why don't you drive up to Torrance Boulevard? We're going to go to the Jack in the Box. I'll buy everybody some Pepsi." I said, "What a cool coach." Drive up to the Jack in the Box. I totally forgot that 15 minutes before class, I took four of what they then call Tylenols. And I'm, you know, I've just been doing heroin and drinking wine, you know. And some guy laid me onto these barbiturates, and, you know, I took them all because I didn't want to get caught with anything, you know. And they... You know, and I totally forgot about them. And you know, these things are, they're half second all half. You're knocked out telling the truth is what you're doing, you know. Every Al-Anon's dream, you know. And these things nail me. And I look over there. Now there's three coaches, you know. And I can't talk. I can't even see the puppet, you know. I can hear the coach says, "Drive up and talk to the puppet." Well, I can't see the damn puppet, man. You know, I can hear the little son of a gun. "Can I have your order, please?" You know, and I'm driving around looking for the puppet, you know, and I go around the parking lot, and I hear this big crash, and this puppet's head's hanging over. I go, shit, I ran over the puppet, and the kid, and the thing's still talking to me. Can I have your order, please? You know, and I panic, you know, and I start running, you know, I run out of the car. The cops tackle me. They shatter my hair on top of the car. I got hair flying, everything, you know. I don't drive till I'm 30. Well, big deal. Got my license when I was 2 years sober. You know, big deal, you know. So you ride shotgun. Let Rudy drive all night, you know. He ain't doing nothing anyway, you know. And, man, you just drive all night, man. You look at those girls, you know, and you just, man, you know, you got it made, man. You know, you're not that little kid no more for a couple hours, man. You're, you know, you're safe, you know. And that, I did that for years and years, man. I love that. I love that way of life. And because I knew when I was sober, it was all going to go away. And I did anything I could not to be sober. You see, I have sobriety has been my problem all my life. Sobriety drove me to drink. It did. I just couldn't stand it, man. I gave it 11 of my best years, you know, and I couldn't stand it anymore. And the book talks about that. That book, Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new, watch it, you know. Get into the doctor's opinion. It talks about me right there. It has that paragraph where it says, there is no answer except for entire abstinence. And then the next paragraph says, this starts a seething cauldron of debate. You bet. I've been debating that my entire life, man. I've been abstinent, and it drives me drunk. I can't stand the way that I feel when I'm sober. I'm restless. I'm irritable. I'm discontented. I got people around me telling me, you know, oh, boy, aren't you glad you're not drinking anymore? And I'm going, hell no, you know. And that used to confuse me coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to think it was a matter of hitting a bottom. Oh, you got to hit the right bottom. You got to hit a bottom, and that'll keep you sober. And it's weird. I hit these bottoms. I'm a bottom feeder. You know, yeah, I keep hitting these bottoms and I set up home, you know. That's pretty good down here. Hit another bottom. I'll just get a TV, you know. And I don't think about a bottom. All that does to me is I'm a survivor. The idea of not drinking never enters my mind, you see. And the memory of my last drunk isn't what keeps me sober. Some people think the memory of the last drunk is what sustains them. But the memory of my last drunk is what motivated me to you. Because I knew perfectly well that I'm powerless over alcohol. That I'm going to drink again. See, if you're new, our book talks about that. It talks. Bill Wilson is constantly thinking that wherever you're reading, you've done certain things before that time. You're at a certain point. Every time he's talking to you about a step, he's assuming you've took the other ones. You see? And he talks about the miraculous things that are going to happen from the steps, and he always talks about what will happen if you don't, you know. And I didn't know nothing about that. I had no idea that I suffered from alcoholism, you know. In 1969, all my buddies are going places, and I don't know what to do. Some of them are going to Vietnam, and some of them are going to San Francisco and turning into hippies, you know. And I thought, well, maybe me and my buddy can go find my roots. We'll go to Detroit, you know, and we wound up in Phoenix. And I'm over at North Central in Roosevelt at the Apache Motel, and I got a $40 a month hotel, and everybody's got a TV, and it's in the lobby, you know, and it overlooks the Wagon Wheel Bar across the street, and all I do is I go to Volt and Manpower, and I drink, and I dream, and I die. And all my life, I can sum up my life if you're new. It came out in my fifth step with a sponsor. My life is just a series of fresh starts. I'm a man who starts over again and again because that's how losers get hope. They don't think about working through anything. They don't think about if they're having a crappy day at work, work harder. They think about quitting. See, that's one of the things you taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anybody can quit a job. One of the things how you stay on a job is right when you feel like quitting and you can't stand it at work anymore, go back Monday and act as if it's your first day at work and work harder. Work as if you enjoy it. Work right through that. And I'm not that kind of guy. I'm a something for nothing guy. You know, all my life I've been a something for nothing guy. You know, and I'm drinking and I'm dreaming and I'm dying. You know, and I'm getting these little goofy jobs. The first job I had over there, I was a tuxedo salesman, you know, in the middle of June, door to door, you know. Look at this, Betty. you know, that lasted for about 2 hours, you know, until it got to be 108, you know. And then I started digging a ditch for a plumber, you know, and he sent me under the house to repair a pipe. And I never came out. Yeah, I had a pint of Kessler's, and I'm underneath this house, and I'm looking out the vent, and I'm going, man, I got a mate under here. I got a pint of Kessler's. Every now and then I bang on a pipe, you know. I got a mate under here, man. I'm drinking that Kessler's, you know, and 12 hours later, they're dragging me out from underneath the house, you know. Got another job. I got another job with another plumber. Dug a ditch for him for a while, and about 4 hours, quit that job. Then my buddy Ernie, I met this guy over at the Wagon Wheel Bar. Ernie was an idea man. Ernie was from Tennessee. Ernie was one of those guys. When you go to a bar, for me, going to a bar is like Halloween. That's why I go every night, is because I know I'm going to be somebody that night. I don't know what it's going to be, but it ain't going to be me. And I'm going to sound like the guy next to me. I don't know why that is. I'm so insecure that I start sounding like people next to me. Like, well, if I have the same accent, they'll think we're chums. You know what I mean? And Ernie was from Tennessee. And I remember having two Boilermakers. And, how are you? Well, I'm doing fine, Ernie. How are you? You know? You know? Next day, I'm in a little Chinese bar. Hi, Mr. Letty. Hi, how are you? You know, I don't care, you know. So anyway, me and Ernie are talking. He goes, I know how we're going to make some money, Larry. He says, not too far from here is a horse track. He says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey. And I said, really? You know, I'm thinking I'm going into training or something like that. How are we going to do that, Ernie? He said, well, I got some stuff here. And he had a bag. Stuff called methamphetamine. And I've just been drinking and doing heroin. I've just been a good guy, you know, and minding my own business, you know. And this guy gave me a bag of that stuff. What do you want me to do? He said, well, look at it. He says, I want you to take a little bit of this, and in 2 months we'll get you down to 95 pounds and go weigh you in and get our colors. I said, all right. Well, I've never taken it before. Well, he comes back a week later because he forgot some stuff, and I'm in the same doorway. I don't want to be a jockey, Ernie. I'm going faster than any goddamn horse in my life, man. You know, I'm chasing flies around the room, you know, and I'm chasing flies, the acoustical tiles breathing, you know, and I'm looking out my window and I'm seeing these black and white flashes, and that's the goddamn sun going up and down, you know. You know, you spend all day just beating your eyes into the next room. You know, my God, man, I couldn't wait to drink, you know. I don't want to be no jockey, man, you know. So I went down to Volt, and I got another job with a plumber, you know. Got another job, faked a knee injury. I couldn't stand him because he was younger than me. I am not working for a guy younger than me. That is not happening, you know. I'm digging this young son of a gun's ditch, you know. So I faked a knee injury, got out of that. He took me to the hospital. I got a prescription for Percodan, and me and Ernie meet these guys from Tucson. And these guys knew some doctors in Nogales, and we start writing prescriptions and selling Social Security cards. And I start writing prescriptions for Seconal and Nembutal and Obitral and Demerol. You name it all. I wrote it all, you know. Damn near took it all, too, you know. And after about 9 months, I'm running around Tucson, and they caught up with me. Well, you know, when you're on barbiturates and whiskey, there's no freeway chase. You know, there he goes down the 75 freeway. Ain't none of that happening, you know. It's just a matter of the sheriff's coming into the Busy Bee Hotel going, well, there's that son of a bitch under there, you know. Always butt naked. You know, leave it to that alky, man. Every time they found me, yep, he's over there in the damn boiler room, butt naked, you know. My God, you know, I've got to show everyone that I'm okay, you know. Drives me crazy. I spoke at a conference in Bakersfield a couple years ago, and we shared the Marriott with 2,000 Jehovah's Witnesses. No, that wasn't a bad deal. But I had this tremendous desire around 3 o'clock in the morning. I wanted to grab my grapevine and go door to door. Just, you know, Bill and Bob love you, you know. Just to see how many of them would open up the door butt naked, you know. I'll get rid of them, you know. Anyway, I did my little 6-7 months over there, and they gave me a $45 voucher to Los Angeles. I took the voucher to the L.A. City Hall, and My probation officer puts me on Anabuse, and I'm on Anabuse, and I'm 2 months sober. And now when I'm getting sober, there's a paranoia that's coming long after the DTs and long after the shakes, and I'm used to the music playing, I'm used to the hallucinations and stuff like that, but there's a paranoia that I'm slipping into that I'm not used to. And at 2 months without drinking and on Anabuse, they find me in a Little League dugout over in El Segundo, California at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'm in between hysterical and maniacal, and I'm just frozen. And they grab me and they take me in an ambulance to the Harbor General Hospital, where they diagnose that some of my drug overdoses have been suicide attempts, and that maybe I need to go to a state hospital for 30, 40 days to be observed. and my probation officer gave me 2 weeks to get prepared for that. Get your Vons bag. What do you, you know, get your toothbrush ready. How do you prepare for that, you know? I know how I'm going to prepare for it, you know. And my little sister, who I never knew admired me till I got sober. I didn't know that my little sister and big sister liked me. I always thought they were in cahoots. And I wanted my little sister to look up to me so bad. And I knew she never did. And I knew I'd lost her attention a long time ago. And her husband lived not too far from me. They had the chance of a lifetime to move to Monterey, California. And they needed to go up there and look at a house. And they wanted me to do one thing. Could you please house sit and watch our dog? We're going to leave Friday and come back Monday, Larry. And we can't take the dog. Could you please do that for us? Oh, you bet. This will be the chance, man. Thanks. You got it. Debbie, don't you? We can't pay you, but there's plenty of food. You can do all you want. Just walk the dog and check the mail. You got it, sis. Friday, 10 o'clock in the morning, they take off. Around noontime, I find out there's a Muhammad Ali fight coming on Friday night. My head starts chewing on me. Why not have some popcorn and a little bit of Thunderbird wine? You'll be home. You don't have to go out anywhere. You just stay in here and drink a little bit of wine, watch the fights, man. Walk the dog. In fact, walk the dog before you get the wine, you know. You got it all planned. You can do that. You can eat the popcorn, you know, and then after the fight, walk the dog again. You know, you got it all planned out. I don't have any money. Well, she's got to have some money around here somewhere. I go through her medicine chest. I go through her bedroom. I start going through her sock drawer. I can't find anything. I go over in the den. I see this big 5-gallon Sparkless bottle, glass, full of pennies. Bingo. Start shaking that son of a gun out like that, man, till I get $1.29. Get my $1.29 out, go down to Kenny's liquor store and get me a big quart of Thunderbird wine. Come running home, like my mouth is just frothing. God, this is going to be good, man. Put on that TV, crack that seal, sit there, and wake up Monday morning to my brother-in-law's foot kicking me in the ribs, dragging me out of his house, saying, "You son of a gun, don't you ever come back to this house again. My dad gave me that dog, and we can't find him." Just to look up to see that the television tube had been broken, the picture window was busted in, the front door was slammed and cracked, and the dog was gone. Her room and the kitchen was askew, as they say. And I didn't know what happened. All I wanted was to watch the Ali fights. And I never forget her crying and yelling at me. And then a week later, I went to the nut house there for 30 days. For the state hospital, and I come out 12 months later, and I was observed there, and they gave me a little bag of antidepressants and antipsychotics, and they told me that I wouldn't be able to operate out in society unless I took these things, and I bought the deal. They were absolutely right, because after 2 months I ran out of Thorazine, and they found me over in Alvaro Street, curled up in the street, a public nuisance, a public drunk. They rolled me up and sent me up to the county farm for about 40 days. And after 40 days, they put about 50 of us in a black and white bus, and they're going to send us down to Torrance South Bay Courthouse, where we're going to be tried and convicted. And at 10 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm in a holding tank exactly the size of this room. There's nothing but cold concrete floors and old bologna sandwiches. I'm sitting on the floor, and I've got a shopping bag and no hope. And I'm listening for the only thing that I listen for when I'm like that, and that's keys. I'm just looking out, just waiting for keys, and I hear the keys coming down the hallway. And I figure, okay, I'm going somewhere. At least I'm getting out of here. And a Scottish man with a patch opened up that jail door, and he slid it open. And he says, "Aye, lad." He says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "My name is Alex." He says, "Come with me. You're going to AA. AA? Well, those are two initials I've never heard of before. I've heard of OR and PO, but what's an AA, you know? And who's this Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? And I'm ready for a long ride and maybe some lunch. And this guy puts me in his blue and white 54 Chevy for a 15-minute car ride. And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he talked you up a storm. It was his day off, and he was down there. His wife was dying of cancer. Nothing will insure us from immunity than intensive work with other alcoholics. He wasn't out anywhere talking about her cancer. He wasn't out anywhere doing anything, but he knew that in order for him to get out of the bondage of self and get his mind off of his personal dilemma, he knew where to go. And he went down to that jailhouse. And he took me for the most beautiful car ride of my life. And if you're new, he told me something that I'd love to share with you. He says the earmark of the alcoholic is that we feel different. We're always eventually feeling different and able to prove that we are. No matter who we're around, what group we're new to, what we're doing, we always feel a little bit different. And if you're new, I want to tell you this, that in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are. I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to let you know that those differences will be shaved away by doing what people around you are doing, not defying them, but getting right in the middle. That's how your edges are rounded off. That's why you feel different. I got a guy that I sponsor, man. He's got all kinds of stuff. I was at the Glendale Mall one day over there in California. This guy walked by me. He's 19 years old. He's bald-headed. He's all tatted down. He's got these big pants you can put about five guys on. He's got three beepers because he's an important kid, right? He's got his mom's earrings on. He's got a nose ring. He's got his ring tied to his lip ring. He's got a chain to his wallet. He's got a ball bearing in his mouth. I walk by this kid, and he goes, "What are you looking at?" I says, "I don't have a goddamn clue what I'm looking at, you know." I wanted to squirt him with some WD-40 or something. I thought he was going to start up, you know. Now I sponsor the guy, you know. "What do you want me to do?" I said, "Well, why don't you unlock yourself, for Christ's sake, you know?" "I feel so different." No shit. How many other people you got see around here wrapped up in a chain link fence, you know? You feel different because you are living different. Look at you, man. You know, you got a pierced ear you can drive a finger through, you know? How many other guys you see looking like that, you see? You're different because you live differently, you know? And so the more different you are, the more qualified you are here. Well, I welcome you. In 1975, he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a little over club over there in Torrance called the TLC Club. And he introduced me to a little lady named Moose and Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singin' Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt and all these other people. My God, I just left a group of people like this, you know. Little Moose was from Louisiana, and she came after me like a toilet paper commercial. She, "Hi, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle." I said, "I bet you are, man." I said, "I'm not it, you know." And then this transvestite came out of the card room, and he starts circling me like a helicopter, you know, and after about his third time around, he landed and he said, "You know, I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting." I says, "I don't think so. Not for my first year anyway, you know." "My God, you got big feet, you know." And "But that's a nice dress you got." And I said, "My God, if that's AA, I'm not sure I want to mess around this place. And if that's the effect of that big blue book, I'm not sure I want to dabble in that either." And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk, 60 days and get drunk, and the longest I could stay sober was 6 months. And every time I came back, I was desperate. But you see, I didn't know about alcoholism. Our book talks about that. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read this. "He had a desperate desire to stop, but he saw no way out. For he had earnestly tried many avenues of escape, painfully aware of being somehow abnormal. The man did not fully realize what it meant to be alcoholic." Nailed me. I thought desperation was do it. See, I'm thinking I'm an alcoholic, I can't drink. I'm an alcoholic, you shouldn't drink. And nothing is further from the truth. If you're an alcoholic, you're going to drink. There is nothing going to stop you from drinking, and that's going to be the baffling feature, because even when you want to stop, you won't be able to. Even when you see your little daughter begging you, even when you see your kidneys on the floor, even when you see all the consequences, even the knowledge of you being an alcoholic isn't going to be enough, because it's all pushed aside when we're sober. See, alcoholism only strikes you when you're sober. And if you don't get into this way of life, you'll never be relieved of the obsession. And the obsession to drink never comes as a form of a drink once you're here. See, that once you're here, the obsession can come back. Yeah, you can do these things and have it removed. But the obsession to drink never comes back as a form of a drink. The obsession to drink comes back as a form of, I don't need to do this no more. Let somebody else make the coffee. I've been at that home group for 4 years. Why do I got to get there early? Let somebody else. And that's how it starts. And you start thinking, I don't need to do this. Maybe I better get my degree. And maybe I've got time to work on my home life. And you start doing that rather than treating this alcoholism like you're always supposed to. You see? And that's how we lose our members. They don't wake up drunk. They work at it. See, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Real good intentions. I don't know about a road getting narrow, but I know the things get less crowded because people forget to do the things that they did when they were new, as if there's a new formula, as if there's something new when you're 15 years sober that didn't apply to you when you're 6 months. There's one formula. And the secret, my dear children, my brothers of Alcoholics Anonymous, we know this so well, that the secret to the good life, the secret to the happy life, and the secret to the fulfilled life is the same formula as staying sober. You don't have to have a bunch of different formulas to get a bunch of stuff done. You keep your primary purpose focused. You put all your efforts into staying sober, Johnny taught me. And he says, kid, the rest of your life will take care of itself. He said, you don't got to go nowhere, nowhere else, boy. He says, you're my son and I want to see you stay here, but you got to stay in the house, kid. Put all your effort into staying sober, Larry, and the rest of your life will take care of itself. And that man is absolutely true, because for 22 years I haven't left your side, and I haven't changed that formula, and I haven't had to go to school to be a plumber. I haven't had to go to school to be a husband. I've watched my brothers and sisters in Alcoholics Anonymous, and in between I'm helping new guys. I'm being treated by turmoil. I'm taking them through steps, and my mind is not focused on my life. My mind's focused on another man getting sober. That's my primary purpose. I didn't know that. In 1980, everybody's doing these 12-step calls on me, and I'm up at the Don Hotel. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. I got a hot plate and a hot TV. You know, I got a PM bourbon bottle cut in half. I got my long hair and no hope, and I'm watching Jeopardy so I could feel like an idiot, you know. Every now and then I get one right. Donald Duck, yay, I am a smart man, you know. I don't need no college, you know. 10 o'clock in the morning, and I hear this, Larry, it's Don. Oh, my God, it's that guy from AA. I didn't even call him, and he's coming over here, you know. He opens up the door, and he goes, oh, my God, kid, what happened? You had 15 days. You're going to be a janitor in the city of Lameda. There's some hope for you, you know. He says, what are you doing, kid? And I took a shot off of that bourbon bottle, and I told Don, I says, I don't want what you have. I don't want what you got. Now, why don't you get the heck out of my room and let me do what I want to do? The cry of this alcoholic. All my life, that's been my cry. Let me do what I want to do. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. And it shot me back to 1967 when me and my old man are fighting. He's kicked me out of the house at 16 because I'm selling dope and getting drunk. And he says, you want to live like that, that's okay, but not under my roof with my two daughters and wife. Get out of here. And me and the old man are going at it. And I made physical contact with my father. Oh, I could joke around with the guys about that. But how that ate me up, my entire life, hitting that man. How it shamed me to no end because I loved that guy, and how easy it was to hit him and how hard it was to ask him for help. Dad, I don't know what to do. I couldn't say that to him. It shot me back to 1972 when the macho man's coming out of an institution and he sneaks into his mom's house and my mom's watching Johnny Carson, and I sneak up on her and she's startled to death and she hadn't seen me for over a year. And I'm in my street mud, and she lays my head on her lap, and she starts rocking me, and she starts praying to this Michigan God, dear, help my baby boy. And I can feel her tears hitting my cheeks as I'm on my lap, and I'm saying, Mom, it ain't that bad. You see? And the kind of selfish guy you have up here is, my mom hadn't seen me for a long time, and she's working at a dry cleaner's, and she's only as far away as from me to the ovens. And I'm coming across this parking lot. And the only thought that I have is when she's working in a dry cleaner's and she's working the cash register, and the only thought that I have is that lady better have a dollar. Now, how come when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm sober and the secretary of the meeting is the same distance, why can't I ask him for a commitment? But I can walk that same distance and crush my mom's heart. Why is that? See, that's the kind of guy I am. That's the kind of guy my sponsor had to work with. See, that's the kind of selfish self-centeredness that came here, you see. And everything that I ever thought about that went out was that man left my room from Alcoholics Anonymous from 1980 to 1982, and I'm stuck with the memory of you, and I can't stay drunk, and I can't stay sober. And every time I get sober again, I come to these rooms, you know. And on May 2nd, 1982, I'm going by a Woolworth window over there in downtown Wilmington. I got my street mud on. I'm 120 pounds and I'm yellow. My shoes are tied in my pants. My eyes are cut. I've got a half pint of Thunderbird in my back pocket. And I'm going, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? All I ever wanted to be was a cameraman. How come I'm getting drunk and getting sober and there's nothing in between? And I did what I always did when I got that way. I panhandled 20 cents and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, Don, this is Larry. I'm ready to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you come and get me? And that man told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He says, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. If you want to get sober yourself, get your ass down here yourself. I'm tired of chasing after you, hotshot. And he hung up. And I said, my God, whatever happened to that AA love, you know? And I walked the longest 10 miles of my life, man. I walked down to that Alano club with my poopy pants and no hope, and I walked down to that club and I pounded on that door because I'd been banned from that club, and they asked me what I wanted. I says, I want to talk to Don. They said, he's over by the coffee bar. I shuffled up to that man and I asked that man something I never asked a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't ask him for a ride home. I didn't ask him for a dollar. I says, Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? And that man lit up like a chandelier for 5 seconds, and then he lit into me for about 20 minutes. You know? And he told me under no certain terms was he going to put up with my nonsense. He says, you make the effort, I make the effort. You don't make the effort, call somebody else, hotshot. I'm tired of chasing you around, and I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm saving the effort for the guys that do it. And man, I got up, and my job was to get out of that mission every morning, get down to that club, go to the morning meeting, and look for work, and get my Social Security card, pay my fines off, and look for work. And I stayed down at that mission for a couple months. And I remember my sponsor bringing me home one day, and I'll try to wrap this up real quick. I know we're okay. And my sponsor taking me back to that mission, you know, and I'm starting to compare because everybody's getting their life together and I'm still down at the mission, you know. He says, Larry, I know what you're thinking, kid. I know what's wrong. He says, but I want you to remember something. He says, there's going to come a day, whether you're 5 years sober or 10 years sober or if you stay long enough, 20 years sober, where you're going to lose every material thing you have. And your life's going to be coming out your sleeve. He says, but you're going to have the knowledge, the experience and the wisdom that when all else fails and you don't have nothing else, you can stay sober in a mission. And there'll be nothing materially binding you. He says, remember how you feel right now and what you're doing. Don't ever forget what's going on with you right now. And I never forgot that. I never forgot what my primary purpose was. And I followed that sponsor around like you do when you're new. I've come to believe in the power of sponsorship. Great things happen to people here in Alcoholics Anonymous when one drunk is talking to another. Great things happen. There is a bond there that can't be beat, an unshakable bond there. It's more powerful than anything I've ever seen in my life. And how I try not to jeopardize that. How easy it is to fire sponsors. Oh, he's not doing... How easy it is to put these sponsors on these pedestals. Don't do that. Put them right there with you. Because they're just human beings. And when they make a mistake, don't fire them. Stand with them. Because they're standing with you when you're making your mistakes. You learn from your sponsor. You know? And that's what I did not do. Because after a year and a half, I started fading from this sponsor. I started judging him. I started holding secrets. And a year and a half sober, I'm sitting in this club and I'm surviving on the junk food of AA and my mind is crying for steak and potatoes. I'm reading this book that's telling me certain things are going to happen and I'm looking around this room and I don't see that. I need to go where this is happening. And a man came down to that meeting and he told me what I was. He says, you're an AA pimp, you're a loser. There's a triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous, son. I hope you find it. And I followed that man, and that man's my sponsor today. My sponsor's name is Johnny, and my home group is the Big Book Group of Bellflower, California. And those are the two most important things in my life, not because of who they are, but because of what's happened to me. He introduced me to a home group. That's my home. That's my home. That's where I do chores in my home. I keep my home clean for my guests to come in. It's my home, like you would your home. If I go to your home, when I get ready to leave, you don't say, "Would you chip in and clean the bathroom?" You know, can I have a volunteer to clean the kitchen? You know what I mean? That's my home group. We have commitments there. We take care of our home because there's an atmosphere that's created when me and you get together that no place else can create. It's the atmosphere where people like me and you can survive and learn to live an enthusiastic, sober way of life. It's within this atmosphere that people like me, who have no religious upbringing, look at you and I find a God. I didn't know nothing about God. But for some reason, by watching you in my home group and watching what you guys do, I can't separate you, God, and AA. I can't think about one without thinking about the other. And I come to love that thing called a home group because I live and breathe in that home group. That's where I learned to serve something I respected. That's where I learned to respect Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where I learned to respect a sponsor. That's where I learned to respect this thing that's saving my life. I don't wear a tie because I'm sharp and effective. I wear a tie because you taught me how to get one. Wear the best for the best thing that ever happened to you, kid. Let them know something happened to you. And me and my sponsor started. I remember the first time I drove with Johnny. He wouldn't let me in his car for a couple months. He used to tell me he's speaking somewhere and then not tell me the address. And finally he picked me up one day and I'm in his car and he says, "My God, you're an intense little son of a bitch." I says, "Well, I'm kind of private." He goes, "Oh, you're a sneak." He says, "What kind of work do you do?" And I says, "Well, I kind of do a lot of things. I'm a jack of all trades." He goes, "Oh, you can't hold a job." He says, do you have a girlfriend or a wife?" And I says, "No, I've always been a free spirit." He says, "Oh, you're a cheater." I says, "You can take me back home anytime now, you know." And I did my fifth step with my sponsor. And I was all ready for him to throw me out of his car. And as I'm sharing this stuff with him, he's sharing me his stuff. And I can't wait to throw him out of his own car, you know. And he didn't throw me away, but he taught me how to make amends to my mother and father. Two most beautiful people I've ever met in my life was my mother and father. I love my mother to death. I love my mom. My mom's in the hospital right now. My mom went in the hospital last week for a hernia operation, and I got scared. And I went to my sponsor, and he goes, "You know, why don't you just try to make her as comfortable as you can, kid, and ease her mind." And I went over there, and I visited. I told my mom before the operation, I said, "Mom," I says, "it's just going to be a hernia operation. It's like getting your tonsils out." I says, "It's just a piece of cake, Mom. Everything will be all right, you know." And she went into that operation, and she came out the next day. And they found 5 more ulcers in her. They found 2 more hernias. And I go to visit my mom, and she's flat out. And she's got all these hoses and the oxygen and stuff like that. And I go to visit her, and I got my little $5 flower. And I tell the nurse that I says, "I'm here to see Mrs. Thomas." And she goes, "Oh, you're Larry. She's been talking about you." And I went in there to see my mom, and she's laying flat. And she looks up, and she goes, "Tonsils my ass." And the next day when I went to see her, you guys came in. My wife came in. Women of Alcoholics Anonymous came in. Because I didn't know what to do for my mom to make her feel comfortable. It wasn't anything I could give her a $20 bill for. It wasn't anything that I could talk her into feeling good, but I wanted to make her feel good, and I didn't know how to do that. And I remember my wife telling me, "Women like to be touched and massaged. That makes them feel good." And I remember my wife telling me that about her. And I'm driving on this way to the hospital, and I never touched my mom. So I went into the gift shop, and I thought about a fragrance that she loved, and it was lavender. And I got some lavender hand cream, this real thick crap. And I went in there, and I said, "Mom," I says, "how you doing?" I says, "I got you some stuff." She says, and she's laying out. I says, "I want to massage your feet with some cream." And she just, yeah, her little feet came right up, man. They were like breathing, you know. And I didn't look at her eyes, and I start massaging her feet. And I start in her leg. And her feet are all swelling up, and I start massaging her feet, and she's going, And I start thinking about my mom and my dad talking. He's never going to change. Where'd we go wrong, Bob? What's wrong with him? We're going to have to lock him up. We can't let him ever visit our family again. And I start thinking of my sponsor going through stuff with his mother. I start thinking about the people of Alcoholics Anonymous who taught me to do the uncomfortable to get comfortable. And I start massaging my mom, and I start feeling good, and she was just so happy. She, oh, honey, and she says, would you do my arms, you know? And it was little actions like that that remind me of how lucky I am to have people around me showing me what to do. I've got a beautiful wife. I've become best friends with my father that I couldn't stand, the 250-pound refinery worker 2 years ago died of liver cancer. But it was my privilege to take care of him and bathe him. And because I was holding hands with men in Alcoholics Anonymous at the end of every meeting and saying prayers and hugging guys when they get their birthdays and being kissed by a sponsor when I get mine, that when I went to show affection to my dad, every day I seen him, I'd kiss him on his forehead, Pop, I love you. I didn't feel weird about it because you showed me how to show affection when it was needed. You showed me how to go over there and visit that little guy and be his best friend and go to Dodger games. And me and my dad became best friends. I love that man today. You see, when I say that, Our Father, I got a beautiful picture. I got a fine picture. It was my privilege, it still is, to be that man's son. I've got great parents. Got a beautiful wife that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been married for 7 years. I met her at an AA meeting 7 years ago. I talked at a meeting in Downey, and I locked eyes with this little Nicaraguan, and I couldn't keep my eyes off her the whole meeting. And at the end of the meeting, we're talking, you know, and she says to me, she says, do you like the backpack? And I go, I love it. I never backpacked in my entire life, you know. Anything to get in the tent, you know. And and I call that lady every day ever since. Now, she don't need me for a thing. She's a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. She's independent. She's self-supporting, but she still hangs around me, so I think she loves me. More important, I know I love her. She's the first woman that I've ever told other women about. She's the first woman that I've ever imagined all day. I wonder how she's doing. She's the first thing that I think about when I'm having all these weird thoughts that men have sometimes, and they have all these weird thoughts about sneaking off and doing stuff. When I feel that way, I call my wife. I see how she's doing, what kind of day you're having. I love doing things to make her happy. I love massaging her feet. I love knowing that when I see her, I've been loyal and things are well. You see, I don't ever want to see her cry. And if I ever have a dream, I wish I'd go to Nicaragua where she was born so that I could kiss the ground that she was born on. I love being with that lady, and I don't want to ever jeopardize that, because the men in Alcoholics Anonymous, they tell me, don't ever take anything for granted here, because if you take things for granted, you lose them. For years, I used to come here, and I was never able to visit my daughter. And my daughter's doing real good because the women in Alcoholics Anonymous told me that if you can go to Texas, you can go to Phoenix and see your little girl. And I wasn't supposed to see her. And the women in Alcoholics Anonymous told me you may not be somebody's husband, but you'll always be somebody's father. Never let her worry where you're at. And she knows where I'm at tonight. My daughter, Lauren, is 16 years old. And she's the most beautiful thing that I've ever seen in my life. And I love being her dad, and I love writing and calling her. And she's doing good in school. She's doing so good. She called me up. She says the kids are making fun of her because she's so smart. She says, Daddy, did that ever happen to you? Like any good alky, I say, you bet. You know, happened to me today, you know. And I love being that little girl's father. I love it to death. I know what that's like. I know what that's like. I don't ever want to jeopardize that. I used to see you folks come up here and take your cakes and tell me about how blessed you were, how many blessings you have. I've been blessed by this, and I've been blessed by my job and blessed by my wife. If you're new, watch these people. Most of them will start hanging themselves with their great blessings because they become so involved in their blessings they forget to come back to the place that blessed them. Take care of the place that took care of you. You used to come up here and say you're sober by the grace of God, and I wanted to feel that way, but I didn't know what it meant because I'm not a schooled guy. So I looked it up, and God's grace is compassion for the suffering. And it wasn't until I started showing compassion for the new man who's suffering and started showing compassion for other people and started sponsoring guys that I started feeling this thing called God grace. Now, I don't have a big riddle or a God phrase to get me off this box, but I know one thing. Every now and then I see a guy take a cake and it makes me feel good. I see somebody he sponsors take a cake and it makes me feel even better. I got a fellowship that I crave. I got a host of friends. And I got a place in me that's at peace every time I see you. So if you're new, I know you believe you're in your final hour. But for me and Mike and Dave and for Steve and for the rest of us, I don't believe that's true, my friend. I believe you're in your finest hour. Thank you.